This week on The Take, we're marking 1 year since a pair of devastating earthquakes hit Turkey and Syria with a new digital interactive. Listen and watch stories of survival, recovery, and coping with the grief at aljazeera.com/earthquakes. Again, that's aljazeera.com/earthquakes.
Washington threatens to take down TikTok in the U.S. At issue, the site's Chinese ownership. But compounding matters is the volume of pro-Palestinian content on the app. Israel invades the Shifa hospital in Gaza again. Rinse, spin the story, repeat. And the looting of Ukrainian memory. Russia goes after museums there. Ten days ago, the U.S. House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to force the Chinese-owned app TikTok to be sold to American interests or face a ban, threatening to cancel a platform favored by teenagers with about 170 million American users has not proved popular. American lawmakers contend that TikTok is a national security risk, a potential tool for Chinese espionage and election interference. However, they have produced precious little evidence to back that up. And there is more to this story than just hawkishness over China. Pro-Zionist forces, influential ones, disapprove of what TikTok has been putting out there, accusing it of harboring an anti-Israel bias over the war on Gaza. Critics say that's a distraction, that there are bigger issues around data protection and bias which plague all kinds of social media platforms, whether they're Chinese-owned or not.
Instead of gun reform, climate change, homelessness, we're actually trying to ban TikTok.
TikTok has been a social media sensation, and for one really simple reason, they basically pioneered this format of vertical video instead of horizontal.
It started off pretty much like other social media platforms as a tool for entertainment with fun videos.
If you're a guy, keep scrolling.
Sup, boys, you're with me today. Check this out.
And quickly, it turned into a tool for people to access news, to discuss global events that matter.
This is what you need to know about what's happening in Gaza right now.
I tend to think of it as, you know, the cool new bar on the street. The younger people are gonna look for a place where the older people aren't, so they don't wanna go to Facebook, to Instagram. These things tend to have a certain generational character.
All of which would be fine had TikTok been launched in Silicon Valley, USA, and not China. Ostensibly, that is why the U.S. House of Representatives recently voted to give TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, 6 months to sell the platform to American interests, or it would be banned, made to disappear from app stores in the U.S.
Today, we take a stand against the Chinese Communist Party and their efforts to turn content creators in America into foot soldiers for the CCP.
The rationale? That TikTok represents a threat to national security. That theoretically, the roughly 170 million Americans scrolling through all those videos could be manipulated politically by the Chinese authorities.
The stated reason for this bill is all about China, that Chinese government could use the control of the TikTok algorithm to push political narratives in the United States.
TikTok is a backdoor for the Chinese Communist Party into every phone in America.
The thing is, no one has actually presented anything that really proves that there's a national security risk here, which has allowed for other narratives to form, right? Is it really secretly about the Palestinian cause, which has become so popular on TikTok?
Please watch this video for 10 seconds to support the people of Palestine.
The history of banning TikTok predates the current war in Gaza, but since October 7th, we've seen another round of rhetoric accusing TikTok of manipulating algorithms, brainwashing people, changing their views to become so-called Hamas supporters.
Thinks your platform is being used to help people who want to destroy the Jewish state.
The use of TikTok to discuss what's happening in the Gaza Strip kind of accelerated the conversation around the ban.
The claims that TikTok is somehow anti-Israel or falsely amplifying pro-Palestinian content. There's currently no evidence that that's actually taking place. The sentiments that you see on TikTok largely track with the demographics of who uses the app. Younger people disproportionately oppose the occupation of Palestine, oppose military action in Gaza, and support the Palestinian people. Some US lawmakers have seized on that, pushed for a ban on the app. But in the end, this is really about, do we want to allow our government to control where we can get news and information from?
The pro-Israel lobby's issues with TikTok spiked after the October 7th attacks. From the early days of the war, pro-Palestinian hashtags, such as Stand With Palestine, were out-trending those on the other side, like Stand With Israel. It wasn't even close. Jonathan Greenblatt is the head of the Anti-Defamation League, an NGO dedicated to combating anti-Semitism in the U.S. Last week, this leaked phone call surfaced. It took place in early November.
The issue in the United States' support for Israel is not left and right. It is young and old. And so we really have a TikTok problem, a Gen Z problem. We've been chasing this left-right divide. It's the wrong game.
And unlike Greenblatt's generation, Gen Z is not exactly enthralled with what mainstream news outlets in the U.S. have to say, particularly their reporting on Palestine and Israel.
As we see the devastation and chaos come out of Gaza, I think there's only one question on our viewers' minds. Do you condemn Hamas?
Large media organizations in the U.S. have been very careful to toe a kind of Washington consensus line around Israel. That has made the voices, the pro-Palestinian voices that exist on TikTok, more noticeable because they're in contrast to what people are hearing elsewhere.
You know, we can blame it on TikTok, we can blame it on extreme left-wing.
It's a very canny political move to say, well, here's this thing that my supporters don't like, and the reason other people are supporting it is because they've been brainwashed with this algorithm.
The confusing thing about the Jonathan Greenblatt at the ADLs is that none of those arguments are being made in the open as a reason for this ban. The ban is very specifically being tied to the China narrative. A lot of people have said actually that their pro-Palestinian content has been censored on TikTok.
See, right there, free Palestine. And it immediately got throttled, and I could tell.
But I don't think I've seen any convincing evidence that there is a bias in the algorithm. The challenge with understanding the TikTok algorithm is we have no transparency into it. So we can only make guesses. And that's true for all of the algorithms and all of social media, right?
Another salient question, is TikTok even Chinese? 20% of its parent company, ByteDance, is owned by its Chinese founders, another 20% by TikTok's employees around the world. The remaining 60% is owned by global investment firms, Western capitalists more loyal to the profit motive than to Chinese communism. People cut from the same corporate cloth as Steve Mnuchin, an ex-member of Donald Trump's cabinet, who is currently putting together a bid to buy TikTok.
And users love it, so it shouldn't be shut down.
That would leave TikTok and Twitter, dominant platforms, in the hands of two MAGA Republicans. What Washington and Beijing have in common on this story is the hypocrisy. With the U.S., the so-called land of the free, threatening to put a lid on freedom of expression. While China, land of the firewall, having banned Twitter and other sites, now condemns America for going after TikTok.
It is very hypocritical for the Chinese government to push back when it has this established record of censorship and surveillance. The move to ban TikTok would encourage other authoritarian regimes around the world to do the same. What would stop a government like Saudi Arabia or any other government that thinks this application is a national security threat? Finally, young people do have the platform to freely express their opinions and challenge existing narratives. And that is seen as a threat by American politicians that see no problem with Israel's genocidal war, but with a Chinese-owned app.
The upper house of the U.S. Congress, the Senate, still has to decide whether it will take the TikTok legislation forward. President Biden has vowed that if it does, he will sign the bill into law.
If they pass it, I'll sign it.
Even though he is currently campaigning for re-election on the platform. Ultimately, though, the TikTok debate is a diversion away from the real issue, the utter lack of regulation of social media in the U.S. compared to the European Union, for example. The way our user data is gathered and harnessed by big tech, not necessarily to our benefit.
We desperately need privacy legislation here in the U.S. It is a national embarrassment that we do not have basic laws preventing companies from harvesting our data and using it to manipulate us. Because whether TikTok is collecting your data or Instagram is collecting your data, once it's shared with data brokers, your data can easily fall in the hands of the Chinese government or another government. So we're not solving any national security problem by banning TikTok. Really, all we're doing is taking away a platform that many, many people use to share their views, to create community, and to express themselves.
We need to talk about TikTok.
If the pro-Israel lobby wants to preserve what is left of the country's reputation, it could forget about TikTok and lobby the Netanyahu government to stop committing war crimes, stop killing Palestinian civilians at such an ungodly rate, stop blocking aid and starving people to death, and stop shooting the messengers, millions of them on TikTok, for merely exercising their freedom of speech, showing their humanity. Because the platform is not the problem, it's the content, and Israel keeps on providing it. Israel has conducted yet another gruesome raid on Gaza's largest hospital, its deadliest yet, and abducted Palestinian journalists trying to cover the story, including one of Al Jazeera's own. Nick Muirhead is here with the details.
This past Monday morning was the fourth time that Israel has invaded Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Military spokesman Daniel Hagari then claimed that hundreds of Hamas operatives were inside the building and had opened fire on Israeli troops. The number reportedly killed as of this recording is approaching 200 and continues to climb. Hundreds more have been arrested.
Until now, we have arrested over 250 Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists that we identified.
That claim is false because among those arrested were several journalists, including Al Jazeera correspondent Ismail Al-Ghul. After his release, he described his treatment in custody.
أجبرتنا قوات الاحتلال على خلع الملابس بشكل كامل والجثو على الأرض ووضع الأيدي فوق الرأس لساعة تقريبا في ظل أجواء باردة جدا وقارصة البرودة.
Along with assaulting the journalists, Israeli soldiers reportedly destroyed their phones, laptops, and several broadcasting vehicles in what appears to be an attempt to erase the footage they had filmed of the raid. Among those killed was Faik Mabou, a policeman. The day before the Shifa attack, Mabou had helped to distribute aid into northern Gaza, where Palestinians are starving to death. The Israeli military insisted he was a, quote, senior Hamas operative. Eyewitness testimonies published by the Geneva-based Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor described the straight-up execution of civilians inside the hospital complex, which would constitute a war crime and fits a pattern of reports of summary executions of civilians by Israeli forces. So when Daniel Hagari says something like this,
until now, none civilians, doctors, medic teams, none have been hurt. Only the terrorists.
It is incumbent upon journalists to call it what it is, wartime propaganda.
Thanks, Nick. Following Vladimir Putin's election victory this past week, which was never in doubt, we're revisiting a story about the targeting of Ukrainian heritage and how it fits into Putin's view of Ukraine's history, his rejection of its right to exist. After Russia's invasion in 2022, museum workers there scrambled to protect their collections from getting ransacked. They knew the Russians were coming. Museums help us understand the past to make sense of the present. And the theft and deliberate destruction of cultural heritage has become a feature of conflicts around the world, most noticeably in the occupied Gaza Strip, right now, where Israel has deliberately pounded Palestinian museums, archives, and cultural sites. In Ukraine, Russian forces have been methodical. When armed men in uniform started showing up at museums, they had a pretty good idea of what they were looking for. The Listening Post's Tarek Nafa now on a war on culture designed to rewrite history and weaken Ukrainian resistance.
March 2022, Melitopol's Museum of Local History, southeastern Ukraine, the first target in a Russian looting spree that began just weeks after the invasion. As the Russians take the city, museum director Leila Ibrahimova buries a priceless collection of Scythian gold deep in a cellar, somewhere she hopes occupying forces won't find it.
The next day, the Russians came for her. They put a hood on her head. They took her, in Ukraine they call it podval. It's a basement where they just lock you up and they torture you. They wanted to know where the collection was. The only thing they underestimated was her character. And when they put a gun to her head, she said, I'm not afraid of you. No, I'm not afraid to die. I'm sorry. Now she's in a safe place, but her family is not safe, so she cannot talk about it. They target museum workers and museum directors specifically because they are leaders for their community. And when they cannot get them to collaborate, then they persecute them.
Of course, Leila Ibrahimova did not let the occupiers know where the collection is, but later some people with special equipment came, and in the basement they found the collection, and they launched a kind of a propaganda campaign, which was widely disseminated through Russian propaganda channels, showing the newly appointed director, who is Ukrainian, telling that, look, this collection was attempted to be looted by previous museum leadership.
Эти мерзавцы наверняка желали продать не только ее, но и все наше историческое наследие.
But luckily, thanks to Russia occupation, these collections are being preserved.
The same week, a group of men turned up at the local history museum in occupied Mariupol, looking for the famous works of Mariupol-born artist Arkhip Kuinji, who many Russians claim as their own. Among the intruders, pro-Kremlin TV anchor Alexander Mozgovoy.
В этот раз прибыли в Мариуполь, если можно так выразиться, целым культурно-информационным десантом.
Mozgovoy questioned the museum's director Natalia Kapasnikova on camera.
Ничего не удалось.
Самая наша большая драгоценность – это оригинал работы Куинджи. Мы его спасли. Он сейчас находится в тайном таком месте.
Off camera, the TV anchor says the director revealed the location of her secret collection, her home. Footage eventually emerged of masked men loading the collection into minivans, and a picture was posted by Mozgovoy, holding Quincy's red sunset on the Dnipro. Then the focus turned to the city of Kherson, and what would become the occupying forces' biggest heist yet. When the Russians first arrived at the Kherson Regional Art Museum, museum director Alina Dotsenko told them her collection had been relocated. Initially, that satisfied them. Dotsenko says the artworks would have remained hidden if members of her staff hadn't given them up.
I knew there were Russian collaborators in the team. They were obvious, and they'd really made themselves known since 2014. I caught them, and they promised that they wouldn't do it again, that they changed, but that wasn't true. They hadn't.
In May 2022, Dotsenko faced intense pressure from Russian authorities. She was summoned to a commander's office and, fearing the fate of other museum directors, fled Kherson. On July 19th, Russian police and intelligence officers moved on the museum.
On that day, six armed men went through the building. They were wearing masks. With them was Natalia Desyatova, a local singer, who introduced herself as the new museum director. They also brought one of their collaborators, Natalia Koltsova. They took the keys, opened up the locker, and everyone saw the collection right there. And the collaborators shouted, "See, we've been telling you for the last 6 months, the collection hasn't been moved. The director and her staff are lying. We will run the museum with you, under Russian governance. We've been waiting for you." When the Ukrainian troops closed in to take back her son, the Russians started moving the collection out of the museum. Some of the pieces were treated with care, but others were just thrown in. We can identify the paintings, because every painting has a number at the back.
As the Russians retreated from Kherson, they emptied the city's museums of around 15,000 pieces of art. Photos have since emerged of dozens of pieces from the collection in a museum in Russian-occupied Simferopol, Crimea. There is nothing random about how the looting unfolded. Human rights groups say the organized operation to rob Ukrainians of their national heritage amounts to a war crime. For the people tasked with protecting that heritage, Ukraine's museum workers, it constitutes an attack on Ukrainian identity. Anything that can be associated with Russian culture has been looted. But dozens of museums, archives, and other cultural sites have also been intentionally damaged or destroyed.
Putin, he is destroying and targeting what he cannot associate with the Russian culture. For example, right behind me, those are the artifacts from the Ivankiv Museum of Local Lore. It was the first museum that was actually precisely hit by Russian missile. And it had a great collection of artworks by Maria Primachenko, a very widely known Ukrainian naive painter, who absorbed Ukrainian tradition into her artwork. They targeted that museum.
And those artists and their artworks are very connected to real Ukrainian identity were neglected or imprisoned in Soviet times. International monitoring satellite laboratories prove that no other building was hit, so it was intentionally damaged. Putin, on the 21st of February, clearly declared that Ukrainian cultural heritage is something which belongs to Russia. And by attacking our cultural heritage, they attack our national identity, trying to just clean up everything which is connected to us as Ukrainians.
Vladimir Putin has repeatedly dismissed Ukraine's history and trivialized the idea of a distinct Ukrainian identity separate from Russia. Ukrainians see continuity with episodes from Russia's imperial past, the push in the 18th and 19th century to suppress the Ukrainian language, or later, in Soviet Russia, the mass targeting of Ukraine's cultural leaders, historians, and writers. In the here and now, Ukraine's heritage is a justification for the war and a target of Russian forces, which makes protecting that heritage an existential issue for Ukrainian culture, a matter of survival.
They started the war because of our cultural identity. They want to erase it. What they cannot possess, they want to erase. How dare you have a different cultural identity and all our cultural heritage? It proves that we are different.
This is a heritage war. This is identity war. And Putin really tries to destroy Ukrainian nation, and one of the main issues is of course our cultural identity. Cultural heritage and the long centuries history of Ukraine, these are things which kept Ukrainians as Ukrainian for centuries, which makes us much stronger, which makes us feel as we are a community which differs from Russians. And this is the most dangerous to Putin.
As the Israeli Prime Minister's official English-language spokesperson, Ilan Levy has been all over the international airwaves ever since October 7th. So when he disappeared this past week, people noticed. It turns out Levy has been suspended from his job. The reason? He got into a Twitter spat with the British Foreign Secretary, in which Levy was caught lying about Israel's blocking of humanitarian aid destined for starving people in Gaza. Now, this didn't happen because Levy lied. He was doing that repeatedly, deceiving the masses on Israel's behalf. It was who he lied to, a member of the British House of Lords. There's a moral to this story somewhere. We'll see you next time here at The Listening Post.